Evelyn, it is an honor to have you here. I am incredibly impressed with the word, I guess, globally about who the best longevity researcher, doctor, scientist is, and the name that comes up is you, and that is so extraordinary that you have this global recognition and presence, and so therefore I'm truly honored that you are here to spend some time with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a great, great honor to be here with you as a personality and as a person. And it's a great honor for me, you know, to be among, I'm sure, many other wonderful doctors and scientists. I'm just one of the puzzles, but I'm very, very grateful for that. Thank you for having me.
I think that the important puzzle and something that I think is incredibly helpful for women to know is to understand longevity and understand your approach to it. And I know that longevity, AI, and digital health, those three seem to be part of your identity. Tell me how those three came together.
No, with pleasure. So it's my great passion really to educate in general. So as a physician and as a, you know, academic person, I teach students and I love to educate also the public. So it's a great, great opportunity also through this channel. And it's so important to learn about the longevity in a credible way because it's always difficult to re-educate people. And we have a lot of, you know, mass information that is not always extremely correct, and it's difficult to explain something that is so very complex. And I believe longevity, especially longevity medicine, is, you know, in comparison to all other disciplines in medicine, the most complex one, the most interdisciplinary one, which gives us beautiful opportunities, but also really granular in a way that it's fueled by several sub-disciplines of other coming from another field, and that's AI. I would say also biotech and computational science. And the reason longevity medicine can do what it's doing, and hopefully doing much more very soon, is because one of the, you know, important components is AI. What we had so far is, you know, a doctor compiling as much data as possible of a patient, processing in the brain, and trying to make differential diagnosis, try to find intersections and paths longitudinally. But it's very hard for a human brain to compile data that maybe don't have an apparent correlation. Let me give you an example. Blood results with results of imaging, radiological imaging, and then also cognitive functions, our memory, and then also our epigenetics, so our environment, interaction with people, functional testing. So many different types of data to put them all together. And not only for one patient, but for millions of them. So this is where AI came to our help. And actually, generative AI, which we now know mostly through ChatGPT, has been in longevity for a while, for a longer while, and enabled us to not only evaluate many millions of data that also had missing points, that, you know, had very different races and ethnicities in it, but also to generate, yeah, to model other fake patients, to teach the algorithms, and to allow us to have something very powerful, which are the so-called longevity diagnostic tools, which we are already applying, such as biological aging clocks, and many others. But it also enabled physicians, hopefully more and more longevity physicians, to really take this amazing, powerful ability and apply them to individual patients to practice longevity medicine, which is like one level above prevention medicine. Yeah, so if we would like to say AI-powered prevention medicine, that's longevity medicine.
It's exciting. I mean, I think the thing I really love most about AI is the personalization of it, whether it's for education or medicine and just everything, that you can really get all of this data, but then it's directed specifically to a person, their abilities, and what you need to know. When I think about longevity, I think about it fast moving, obviously, the information, AI and medicine moving quickly. The information is fast and furious. And I think ultimately, with the speed of it and the information we'll have, prevention is really the ultimate dream that every generation to come has a chance to take steps to do the best things for that the individual through this data. What is being done now in that respect?
Right. So I also look really optimistically into the future. And I always open my speeches with a slide from Alice in Wonderland, where she's running with the Red Queen and running, and then they are stopping and she's asking, why are we in the same place? And the Queen is saying, well, if you want to move something forward, you have to run double as fast. And this is longevity medicine for me, right? We are learning all the time. We have to keep up with the speed, but in order to move something, we have to do double as much. And luckily, many people and many groups are doing that, and really putting their own passion and time into it. And in that sense, I think I can just mention a few. What is very important are, you know, trackers and monitoring tools that are being also immediately translated, or the data from it translated into AI algorithms, so we can make better predictions and really optimize, individualize at the highest level in three dimensions, actually, not only for the person, but also for that time at that specific place, to optimize all the things that we already know, the lifestyle interventions, you know, from sports to exercise to food, but at a level that was never known before. At the same time, of course, we know that that will not be enough. Yeah, we also have to have a panel of specific compounds, drugs, and supplements that will enable us to further optimize our health span. And for this, we have AI-based drug discovery companies that are doing amazing work, like in silicon medicine, working on compounds that can immediately target something that is age-related, like fibrosis, and at the same time working on aging, specific disease-related pathologies. But also, we will see a lot of intersections, hopefully, between sick care and longevity medicine. I also actually don't like this way, you know, to frame it, sick care. I practice sick care. I'm still at the hospital. I like to say it's reactive medicine. We react to a disease. We try to cure it. And I work in internal medicine and oncology. And seeing cancer patients, one might say, well, you know, you don't think about longevity having cancer, right? And it's not correct, luckily. Because we know that a lot of so-called senolytics, so really medications that will target aging, are also helpful for cancer patients.
Interesting.
And a lot of diagnostic tools, even biological aging clocks, can help us not only to triage cancer patients, but really predict for them how much toxicities they will have. That's a very powerful tool. Yeah.
So let me ask you a question then. So what would be some of the medications that are used for cancer patients that could be interpreted for longevity?
Right. So we have, for this, we have like two approaches. One is, like you mentioned, what could be the medications that we know and we could use them for aging. We call it repurposing drugs.
Yeah.
I think the best example is at this moment are the mTOR inhibitors, right?
Yes.
So the famous rapamycin, sirolimus, and so on.
Right.
But there are also other compounds that people are looking at. mTOR inhibitors are still the most promising ones.
What about rapamycin? Is it being used or is it still sort of testing?
Well, it's still not approved for anything else, right. But you know, tumor related pathologies and or prevention of organ rejection after transplants. But of course, there is a lot of off-label use already. However, there are no clinical trials yet that have been published and would have a very, you know, comprehensive cohort that would be representative. So no, not yet, but mm-hmm. we are working on it. And hopefully soon we will see some good data coming out. But that's the repurposed drug area, right? We also have an area that is working on senolytics, and those are still without names. So they have the so-called compound names, RXXX or right. something. And I think that's the area of a huge promise for us. Yeah.
Very exciting. And in the cancer research, you mentioned that there were other findings that led towards uses for longevity. What are some of those, whether it's lifestyle or whatever? What have you found there?
Right, several things that you mentioned. So for sure, the lifestyle. We, right now, I would say we revalidate things that we already thought of or assumed, such as, you know, how is BMI related to cancer? Mm-hmm. How is consumption of alcohol related to biological age and therefore some specific cancers? So things that are not shocking, but it's very nice to validate them and to have numbers fixed to it.
Right.
And then understand.
Excuse me, let's go back a bit so everybody understands the BMI. So let's talk a little bit about BMI. And have a big conversation about alcohol, because I really believe that that is an under-evaluated topic. So BMI, let's talk about any numbers or status or information that the audience can take a look at and sort of think about for themselves.
Right. So BMI, related to really so the correlation between our weight and height. What a very recent study came out that was very powerful, I think, because it brought into light really the longitudinal influence of BMI being increased for a lifespan of over 20 years and how that increased a risk of cancer. The specific cancers were like colon cancer and breast cancer, those that also have a very huge incidence. So they happen very often all over. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the increase of risk was, for different cancers, was varying between 5 to even 13%. A huge amount, yeah. If you think about global population. But at this point, also allow me to mention one thing that is very underrepresented, and the information is our number one risk of cancer for all type of cancers, almost, you know, with very, very few exceptions. The number one risk for cancer is age, right? Mm-hmm. Not genetics, mm-hmm. not what we eat, not alcohol even, is the age.
Yes.
Right. So, yeah.
Well, aging obviously is not a disease, but it is the high sort of probability for things to start to happen. The body is wearing out. But in the practice of positive longevity, there are these things. So in the height-weight ratio, is there a ratio that you would recommend to everybody to understand? Like if you're in a certain height, what your weight should be? Is there a measure for that we could look at?
Right. So I think just to point on that, when we say age is the biggest increasing factor, now we are going to longevity and say it's the biological age, not the chronological age, right? And so how can we decelerate the biological age pace, mm-hmm. right? How can we lower it? One of the ways is to lower the BMI, right? And everything that is above 25, per long-term statistics mm-hmm. and kind of an old knowledge, is, you know, at an increased risk. Also in this new study, they took people with that BMI. But right now, we also know that the BMI might not be the best marker, because as we know, muscles, they are heavier than fat. So people who have a big muscle mass might have a higher BMI, mm-hmm. or people, let's say like this, with the same BMI, might have either a lot of muscles, a little fat, and they will be healthy, they have low risk. And then people with the same fat amount, the same BMI, might have a higher one. So rather than going just by BMI only, okay. right, we look at the body composition.
Right. I remember having my biological age done, and I'm 78, and the biological age is obvious, but then at 53 was the biological age, and I was like, that's not good enough. I want it to be 30. It's like, just unrealistic. But I think what happens with aging is your brain still understands, and I'm sure your brain is telling you you're 27 in your kind of sense of yourself. And I would like to say it never goes away. So I don't think anybody will be actually ever happy when they find their biological age, except to hope that it's less than the chronological age. But I think the more we can know, I think for all of us to do more research on our own body mass understanding, I think is really helpful. I also, again, understand age is the number one risk. But with alcohol for women especially, I don't think we have enough of a conversation about it. And I think for me, I never drank in my life. It just wasn't anything I ever did. I didn't feel good when I drank, so I never did. And I attribute that in a big way to how I feel today. I think it's one of the big factors. And I don't know if this is a big enough deal for me to talk about more, but I would love your opinion about it, especially for young women and understanding our body weight and alcohol consumption. And is it really something we should be doing?
All right, so thank you for mentioning this. It's also multi-complex thing, and we don't have good studies for the simple reason that you cannot really do head-to-head comparison. You cannot have, you know, a group drinking a lot and a group not drinking and, you know, follow them for right. 20 years. But very, very simple answer is, of course, if you can avoid, avoid, because it will only bring you benefits if you don't drink, especially in early age. So when we are talking about women that are premenopausal, and this is a time when the estrogen is high, when you are, you know, at the biological period of your time where you are ready for reproduction. The biology made it this way because this is your time to reproduce. This is also the time where all the organs are at a high level and susceptible to damage. So you decide to drink excessively, you will ultimately have the damage happening. Maybe you will not see it immediately because ultrasound cannot catch it that far. Mm. And we will not do, you know, intensive, expensive tests like FibroScan for everybody. But yes, you will impact your liver, your colon, and so on. You will put more on weight because this is the way, you know, we usually respond to stressors as females. And in the long term, when you will be postmenopausal, those changes will show much stronger.
And I think the reaction with hormones, especially when people are perimenopausal or going through menopause and they drink, I think that it sort of amplifies any of the experiences they're having. But I thank you for that because I feel there are things we can do and we can think about and choices, and that would be one I think more people would think about. What does the immune system have to do with all of this. You know, we think about having a strong immune system, but in the picture of longevity, how does that, how should we look at that?
It's a big thing. If I might just go back to one of those things,
okay.
You know, if for somebody alcohol is a quality of life, a huge factor, I never force my patients to stop drinking, but
mm-hmm.
I tell them when, how, what are the nutraceuticals that we can use around it. However, if somebody is not convinced that alcohol and smoking are impacting biological
right.
age, they can Google. There are studies. Actually, just last week, there was a study that showed that alcohol is increasing biological age. Yeah.
Okay.
And for smoking, we have those data for a long time already. So very important
yeah,
part.
Especially for young girls who... We felt that we were invincible and that nothing could happen, and other people were old, but not us. So you do things that maybe you don't think about in long term. But I think if you can see when you wake up in the morning and you drank, it's not a pretty picture. So it's just pretty versus healthy, you know, they kind of go together.
Yeah.
So the immune system.
Right. And both of those substances affect also immune system, right?
Yeah.
Big time. And our immune system from the age of around 16, when the thymus is involved, like when we are moving to the point where we have to really rely only on our already shaped immune system, that is the time where the problems start. Immune system is related to aging on several levels, to the point that it's included in the hallmarks of aging. We have, you know, we had 9, now we have 12, but and there's many more. But immune aging immune aging, actually, they put it into one word, is very closely related. We know more and more that there are specific cells in our immune system that are strongly related to also like a sterile inflammation. So if we cause damage in our immune system, not only are we susceptible to external stressors that then fuel the inflammation in our body that increases our biological age, but at the same time, those cells are causing like autoimmune responses
mm-hmm.
That we don't see and we barely can measure,
mm-hmm.
But they happen. And
wow.
They accumulate over time. So immune system is very, very important, yeah.
I think my interest in the immune system actually happened after 9/11, when I was really trying to learn about healthy lifestyle prior to that. And then the shock of 9/11 to a population that would forever have a memory of things like this can happen and that there's a stress level that people live under,
mm-hmm.
not just here, all over the world, as we know. And so that level of stress has an impact. And what is that impact on the immune system and how do we sort of neutralize it?
All right, so a very, very important point, stress. Physiological stress is a big component, and we have good and bad stress, right? We need some level of hormesis
mm-hmm.
and good stress to keep us going. It's a very positive. But then there is this external stressor that might take us out of the balance. That will immediately translate into higher level of cortisol and also other adrenal hormones. So again, we are at the level of hormones here that fuel our decrease in the immune system, again, then susceptibility to all the stressors that usually we would not think about, making us sicker and aging faster.
Mm-hmm.
How to prevent that? Well, internally and externally, right? So external things that we can do is all the types of therapies that we can, you know, psychologically
right.
try ourselves. What can we do internally? There are ways to also increase our immune system and to put down a little bit the level of cortisol in our body, be it through supplements and, of course, through exercise and better sleep
mm-hmm.
and so on. And the good thing is we can measure now. Yeah.
Which supplements do you, I mean, there, I think it's that there's so much and it's confusing. Mm-hmm. And if you personally were going to pick a supplement to support your immune system, what would you choose?
Well, not to make any, you know, commercial.
No.
You know, I like to make sure that there is enough supplementation of zinc and selenium in my patients. Even, you know, before winter and, mm-hmm. and extensive travels. Of course, vitamin C and iron, but also low dose of tryptophan are very, you know, helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Also for this type of lowering of immune function versus depression. You know, mm-hmm. we have this winter downs and stuff like that. More and more studies are showing very good effect also on, you know, like phosphatidylcholine, anything that is working on the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, PCP is also working on the liver and the brain. Now this axis, yet another thing for mm-hmm. alcohol and, you know. So those are the mm-hmm. things that I always work with.
What about magnesium?
Oh, very, very important part. Yeah, that's like absolute have to be.
I think that to me is something that more people should be aware of. And I mean, the more I learn, I think magnesium, and I actually am aware of how much better I feel mm. when I take magnesium, and I found some brands that I really can see the difference in the quality. And I guess everybody has to do their individual research on that, but that was super helpful. I think everybody wants to have a tool and to be able to do something, and supplements are tricky because they're all different qualities of supplements, but doing research and finding the ones that work best are great. If the immune system is understood and dealt with, and we favor certain things that will support the immune system, what are some of the other recommendations that you would make to support longevity in lifestyle?
In lifestyle, I would say for everyone, focus on the five main areas, right? Improve your sleep. Think not only on the quantity of your sleep, but specifically the quality. And by this, I don't only mean the REM phases, but really what's your oxygenation during that time? What's your glucose level during that time? What's your blood pressure during the night, and so on. And with the trackers right now, we can follow this. One of them, but mostly those.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yes, oh, really? Yes. So I'm very blessed to live in a country that produces a lot of trackers that are very accessible. And I know 24 hours blood pressure measurement, and also
I'm so jealous. I'm obsessed with the tracking, especially sleep.
Mm.
Sleep is really complicated. There's a lot going on. So, and why is that? Why is sleep so important? And why is REM sleep important and deep sleep? But what makes that important for longevity?
Right. So from several aspects, you know, sleep is really one of the main elements. Number one, it's because it's really the time your brain regenerates and consolidates. It's the best way to prevent neurocognitive decline later on. And that's a very big part of longevity.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is because all of the other organs are also partially regenerating during the sleep, right? And it's also the only part of your 24 hours where your microbiome can start to function and reproduce. That's your time where the liver can partially regenerate, and so on. But at the same time, it's important to have, so that's the REM, for example, for the consolidation. Mm-hmm. But why the oxygenation is so important? Because you want to make sure that your brain gets enough oxygen during that time. And that's a big part of the quality of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Not only people who have sleep apnea are at risk. You might not even know that you have too mm-hmm. little during that time. Or low level hypoglycemia, meaning your glucose is too low during the night. Happens a lot. And that's also not good. Yeah, that's actually quite bad for your liver and your brain that is wow. fueled by glucose. Right? All those little tiny tricks.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what is more important, sleep or fitness?
I get this question a lot, interestingly.
I knew that's because people talk about that yeah. all the time.
No, I'm fascinated by yeah. this question, actually, because, you know, I actually, you know, my answer would be both equally,
right.
but I actually try to, you know, to play this game with myself, like, okay, let's put it, you know, the things here and the things here and compare how many. Really both, because it's what's more important for you in longevity. I mean, for you as a, for anyone, is it your brain longevity? Or is it your physical mm-hmm. organic, your body longevity? And of course, partially fitness will influence brain and sleep will right. influence body. But where do you want to be? You want to be at a balance? Then it's 50-50.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a theory for a while that when you're your age, it's sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're my age, it's fitness and physical activity, because you want to have physical strength to sort of age comfortably and without devastating accidents. But every time I think about that, I think, well, have to have my brain. I'm sorry. So it is. That's why monitoring is so helpful. Also, the different quality of sleep. Sometimes I think I had a great night's sleep, and I look at the monitoring, and it wasn't so great. Mm-hmm. And it really, but I could have 4 hours, and it was really great. Just like some breaker, and then I get up or whatever, and that 4 hours was amazing. So I think the more we track, the more we can understand our own kind of habits. And then food and supplements are kind of in the same package, right? Of what are your thoughts about that?
So, supplements are really an area that we still need to work a lot on,
mm-hmm.
right? We need trials, because we need to know when, for whom, how much, and so
yeah.
on. That's really unexplored. But if you have a physician who can track you and knows what to measure when, so that you don't put yourself at a danger, and also to give you the right mix, because there are interactions even
mm-hmm.
between supplements,
yeah.
Then, you know, you are on a fairly, you know, safe side. At least you will not cause harm,
mm-hmm.
right? Maybe there will be no obvious benefit, but it will not cause harm. But another thing is the nutrition. Here, you really need to have a good guidance. Again, you can monitor a lot, not only glucose. We have now trackers for continuous cholesterol monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
We have body composition scales where you can track it daily, right? And again, it doesn't have to be 100% accurate.
Mm-hmm.
You need the trends as a doctor to see. And you want to make sure that your microbiome is at the right, with the right composition and proportions. So what I am looking personally at in my patients for food, for nutrition, is really to, number one, make sure that the metabolism is fast. I try to always accelerate the metabolism and metabolic rate, the way, you know, they choose the food, they combine the foods, they, you know, do intermittent fasting or not, you know, it depends on what stage they are and how we can fit it into their lifestyle. And then secondly, also to make sure that I track them the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not only about the weight, you know, we were talking about BMI. So if we have nothing else, that's great to have that BMI. If we can have more, and, you know, now the trackers are getting less and less pricey, luckily, and I hope
yeah.
it will go down. So really everybody can
yeah.
afford it. Or insurance companies will cover it, hopefully,
mm-hmm.
very soon. that will make a huge impact.
Yeah. That was my next question, is the future of medicine, as you said, is AI and technology. And the dream, I guess, would be to, in almost in a preventative way, to go and have a measurement of everything that is tracked and trends are looked at, and you can just get some telemedicine type data sent to you. Check this, you need more calcium, check, you know, that kind of thing. Is that possible in the near future? Where are we with all of that?
So it's definitely possible. I strongly believe that it is. What we need for that are several things, and that will determine how fast it will happen. Number one, we need to train the algorithms on more data. And for this, we need longitudinal trackings. Therefore, there are now attempts, you know, there are many longevity centers and clinics happening all over the world. And we created this Healthy Longevity Medicine Society to really bring conclusive guidelines and recommendations, how to track things, so we can then compile it and compare it. So that at the end of the day, you will, you know, have the opportunity not always to ask the doctor, but, you know, have a few buttons in your digital platform that will tell you, at least in the safe area, what to increase, what to decline.
Yeah.
Another thing that is very important is that we need to actually have the right supplement mix for those patients. And the AI-based drug discovery that is happening right now in some mega AI labs will be minimized to a things that will stand in your, you know, bedroom or somewhere, and you can immediately produce whatever you need.
So exciting. And what would even be more exciting is when we can get to the same healthcare for every human being on the planet. Anybody that can get a phone, anybody that can have that, to have this is really the future of medicine, I would think, right? The ability to be your own advocate and be, you know, getting accurate information. That's when I say to people, why are you afraid of AI? Yes, there's a reason, but not for what you're talking about. It's just, I'm sure every day you're exhilarated by something new that is happening so quickly. It just must be the most fun job, I have to say. I'm jealous. We can, maybe you can do some hems someday.
Whatever.
Yes. So what in your world do you see as coming next? Like, what, we did talk about the future just now, but if you had a dream, I'm sure you have many, if you had a dream that you would love to see happen, what is that? What are you thinking about now?
Indeed, I have many dreams for longevity, for, you know, globally. I would like, you know, and we are working on it, but I would love to, my dream is to have it faster. Number one, to bring longevity education for everyone, but especially at medical universities, for the medical students and for doctors at all the levels, for having more and more of us to guide that field in a credible way. And the credible way would be, you know, as a doctor, we make the oath, do no harm is the first part of it. And I think for me and for many of my colleagues, do no harm means also do not deprive anyone of the access to longevity medicine and to take the best preventative care of themselves. So number two, my dream is really to have all the stakeholders working together to equip everybody with the access to longevity. Insurance companies, you know, states and governments to implement longevity into the public health, keywords, healthy cities, healthy populations, to have other stakeholders actually to fuel it, to give the resources. We need also, you know, the necessary resources for that. and have AI and biotech give them, you know, give them an access to the daily life, increase the maturity of population to AI in a credible way, but also without unnecessary limitations. So again, we see China, where AI is in a daily life so present that increases your efficacy and productivity, but also gives you the, you know, a very, very cheap way to increase your longevity. And then my last dream is really, one of the main ones is that we will have a fast track for clinical trials for manager protectors and senolytics, so that as longevity doctors, we have more tools of interventions other than just really individualized lifestyle.
Yeah. So in China, I am just fascinated by how quickly technology gets integrated into the population, society, and what are some of the observations you have in, especially in your world, where the population is actively engaged in some of the this future kind of look at longevity?
Luckily, many places by now. So, of course, I'm very biased in terms of China's progress, and a lot of the things that are happening there are still not even announced. For example, you know, we are implementing AI to pretty much all technologies right now in the hospitals, really in the clinics. And that's a big step. But also in terms of longevity, again, AI-based drug discovery, China, technologies for trackers, China, and a very, very open government towards those things. So one of the main goals for the 5 years, for example, was optimization of health for the, they call it the working population. Again, so we are looking at people from 20 to like 50 or 60, right? And that's the time where you have to start at least there, right? But we see this also in America. You know, we have here also great progress in the political areas, you know, people who accelerate this progress. And we have AFAR and many, many, you know, especially science-based parts. Middle East, Israel, Emirates, Saudi Arabia, great players, big leaders in longevity, all of them. And then more and more countries, like we are now, if I may announce even, right? So just yesterday we have this longevity education hub where we are educating physicians, but also all the population for free on longevity. And we had it for like 3 years and we're making national chapters. Wow. People actually volunteer to translate it.
And what method is this education? To what mediums?
It's an online course. Okay. We did it during the COVID time, actually.
That's great.
Yeah, it's a curriculum. It's still, since that time, the only curriculum for physicians that is CME accredited by the MCAA.
Wow.
Which is a very, very high level of credibility. Yes. It's a council and we get revalidated every year. Over 6,000 physicians all over the world took it. And we have it now in Chinese, in Portuguese, in Spanish, in Indonesian. And we are implementing this curriculum into universities.
Yeah. I did a longevity head-to-toe examination in Abu Dhabi, and it was fascinating, and their enthusiasm about AI and health and all kinds of areas is extraordinary. And then I've done some here too, and it's such a look into the future. And I am actually offering myself up as this old specimen of 78. And I say it, I'm proud of my age, because I think even at my age, it's best to start as early as possible. And I say that all the time. But even at my age, I think there has to be an optimistic approach towards health, in not just solving a problem, but how do we anticipate? What should we know? How do we look at a potential problem? And so that we can live longer and live better and function and be a participant in society. I think there is so much of a shortage of labor in many ways, and there's this older population that if they feel good and they're using their brains and they're active all the time, they can participate in so many ways where we need people to be a part of what's going on. So I'm hoping that more of the population post 50, post 60, 70 will be active and can use some of this information. And I'm learning more about that. And obviously, that's I advocate for, you know, old and strong and aging with power. If you had to recommend to a parent, they give birth, they look forward to having a child and thinking about the child's future in this age. So there's a lot of the sort of negatives we think about, what, like all of this brilliance we have with our technology is also a stress on development in some ways. And then there's all of this brilliant, exciting look at medical health, educational health. What would you advise as sort of a plan, just from your view of everything? How would you advise parents
to look at their health or the child?
The child.
So I think, you know, it's a very good point. It's never too early to start and never too late to start in longevity. And if you are a parent to be, or you're just thinking about becoming a parent, you should start with your own longevity. I have a lot of couples coming to say, how can I optimize until pregnancy to get over, you know, the pregnant, post-pregnancy things, of course, obvious ones, both mentally and physically. But also we know that people who are better prepared for pregnancy, the children are more prone to be healthy. So you give a part of a healthy longevity already by preparing yourself properly to pregnancy. But then for the child, don't overthink, because it's complex and complicated. And longevity in children, pediatric longevity, is really just burgeoning. So it's very, very starting. However, there are a few things that can be done. And again, it's never too early to start. So prevention from the early childhood is a very good thing to do. And again, focus on the core areas. Make sure the immune system is right. Make sure all the nutrients are there that are needed for the growth. Make sure you put the right rails for the child in terms of not going to diabetes, high cholesterol, and so on. Make sure that there is a good circadian rhythm that will help a lot with the intelligence, much more than all the tutoring you will ever do later.
Really?
Yes.
Really? And why is that?
The circadian rhythm in a child, enough sleep, and putting circadian rhythm to really train the brain to regenerate and consolidate in a much better way.
Okay.
Will help a lot.
That's great advice.
Yeah.
That's great advice.
Very, very important. And of course, the fitness. The faster you start with a child to train in the right way at the right time to build up a muscle mass, the better the outcomes later, because the muscle mass memory will be a great, great help for the next, for the future.
Yeah.
But also the bone health, right? Bone health for children and later teenagers, for women, pregnancy and so on, and later for older age, whatever you can do at that time is very beneficial. Yeah.
It sets the tone for the lifetime. That's why I asked you about that, because I really do, I'm learning that it's not too early. And I didn't even realize until you just said all of this how critical all of that is at such an early age. And every time I see a birthday party with cake and Halloween with candy, and I think, we are poisoning our children. Like, why are we celebrating with poison? This is a mindset that we don't want to give up the fun party part of it, but there needs to be a company that comes up with something that is so much fun and so good for children that they only want to party that way. Do you know what I mean? It's like almost like a propaganda piece. Like, this is how you party, and stop all of that. I don't know why we just keep doing that, but there's nothing's come to replace it, obviously.
Right.
So you travel, I'm sure you work very long hours and are, I know when you love something, it's hard not to. So I'm as much as much as you. Maybe we have this joy that we have something we love and appreciate it. But how do you balance for yourself? I mean, what kind of disciplines do you try to impose so that you don't neglect your own health? That's obviously, sometimes people who are doing all of these things then just do it because they have to and neglect sleep. So what do you do for your guardrails?
Indeed, I wish I had a better discipline in terms of sleep. That is the part of my life that I still, I should take a better care of that. But I try, what helped me a lot is intermittent fasting. That helped me so much to sleep better.
Mm-hmm.
And, we had this game as medical students that when you mention I sleep only 4 hours and I wake up, I feel great, and I sleep 8 hours and we are sleeping in a cycle. And if you hit the right time to wake up, this is where you're most productive. So understanding and tracking my sleep helped me definitely to be more productive in that way. Intermittent fasting was another thing. By the way, great impact on sleep if you do intermittent fasting.
And so what is your rhythm for intermittent fasting?
I started a long time ago. Right now it's usually between 10 to 5. On better days, I do 11 to 4.
Meaning 11 to 4. When do you start your fast and end your fast?
Right. So I eat from like 10 to 5. I eat from 10 to 5 and stop at 5. And I'll try to do that at least every day.
And so you obviously, like me, don't have dinner out with people very often because they eat at 8 and 9 at night. And how can you go to sleep when you eat so late? That's my, socially, it's a game, right? It's a hard game. Not that I want to eat late at night, but you do want to socialize with people. I think finishing by 6 o'clock for sure is like, you can't eat after. I mean, 5 for me is a perfect time to have dinner.
Right.
So how does that work socially?
It's still a challenge, right? Because as you say, we have those fixed points in our cultures, the social drinking and social eating and late and the candies and this. First of all, the mindset is changing. Many people will understand already. And I suggest to go for a walk, to socialize. Or we have food massage. Now in China, that's also part of a social life. Or I do, there are official dinners that I anyway frequent, but I would just drink, right? And if it's a environment that is familiar with me, they don't mind.
Right.
They don't care
right.
if I eat or not, or they know.
Which those are the best.
Yes. But those who don't, you do your best not to show up.
Right. And you don't want to talk about it. So it's tricky. And I remember when I decided that I didn't want to eat meat because I didn't feel good, but I never wanted to have to explain it. So we're going into this cycle again of, okay, if we don't eat late and we eat within a period of time, you don't want to talk about it, but it is wonderful when you find other people you're having dinner with. I actually had a dinner the other night at 5 o'clock, which was the earliest dinner, but it was everybody's like, we want to be done by 7:30, and that's it. And it was great because then you can go out, you can exercise, you can run, you can do whatever you want. And so it's such a freedom. But so intermittent fasting, you said, is great for sleep. What else does intermittent fasting do for us for longevity, let's say, specifically?
Right. First of all, intermittent fasting is one of the very few longevity interventions that are proven by studies that influence biological aging. And, you know, from many sides, it's also all mTOR inhibition kind of a thing. It's also activation of our internal senolytic effects. It also allows our microbiome to regenerate and mitochondria. So many, many things when you look at all the hallmarks of aging. It's kind of a mini activator of all of them. At the same time, it really helps to sleep, that's for sure. And for those who, you know, tend to eat also the right things during that time, also increases the metabolic rate. Yeah, so, but it's very important, I have to say, that intermittent fasting doesn't mean reduce everything to one meal, right? Not for everybody that is the right way.
Yeah.
For most people, it won't be the right way.
Yeah.
You want to put a little bit of stress onto your body, not to the point where your body will then be in a state of stress that will lead to accumulation of everything that you eat because you are at war, right? So you would grab every cucumber and store it.
I love that. I mean, I think we're going to take that clip because it is so sensible and logical about intermittent fasting. I think it's, I'm so glad you said that because I think there's confusion about the strictness of certain things and sometimes creating stress for the body, whether it's a cold plunge or whatever the theories are for that. But sometimes, and I think especially when it comes to fasting, there's a different logic that we need to look at. And it's also individual in many ways too, right?
Yeah.
And I really love fasting. For me, I'm so busy during the day anyway that it's just not a big deal for me to do. But I really eat better because I look forward to when I'm going to eat and what I'm going to eat. And I think when people do that, they're more focused about what that meal's going to be rather than just eating because you're hungry and not thinking about the rhythm of it. I also think having a good digestion and going to the bathroom regularly is like a great part of it. Nobody really wants to talk about poop, but how important is that?
Oh, microbiome community will love talking about poop, right? And I love it too, actually. So it's extremely important, right? It's our natural way to release the bad things from our body, bad metabolites, also dead bacteria, right? So it's very important, and intermittent fasting regulates, this type of regular defecation very, 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 very nicely. Number two, as I mentioned, metabolic rate increase is a very important part of what we eat and how we eat and how we put the interval for a person. Will it be one meal, 2 meals a day? How, and that will also strongly influence the composition of your stool and how much of the bad things that you produce in the body will be actually taken out, right? So the way our body is actually forming the stool is a whole science, super fascinating.
Really?
Yeah. You know, how much will be absorbed from the colon into the stool, how much water is in it, you know, or not, and how this changes over a period of your life. How will pregnancy, you know, influence that? So many important things. And how, last but not least, how we can also support to have the best, you know, combination. How to improve the microbiome, that is also extremely important on the stool production. So, you know, it's all extremely, extremely interrelated.
And how often is there a healthy code for that, or?
Super individual. So of course we would say, you know, from old type of studies, at least once a day, preferably at the same time every day. And, you know, preferably like a middle way consistency. There are actually scales for how the stool should look like. But it's highly individual. If somebody has two or three times stool a day, why not? Maybe there is bigger quantities and it's a healthy stool. Somebody will have it every second day. Not so optimal, but maybe it's enough, right? So very individual in that sense.
Yeah. And I also think intermittent fasting is super helpful for regularity. And I find that incredibly helpful. And I just... I think that if we're eliminating waste, getting it out faster than having it hang out for a while can't be good, because it's sort of, you know, garbage out. Let's get it out. I think understanding that nobody's really talking about that unless they're selling a product that has something to do with it. But I think understanding that a little bit more is incredibly helpful. And I think understanding that intermittent fasting is such a help for that regularity and for sleep, which you beautifully described. So I think on a final note, first of all, I think the more people can become aware of longevity and how to interact with the concept of it, where would you recommend that they learn about it, or how can they be educated? Is there something available that we can read or follow for updates? Is there anything you could recommend?
Sure, with pleasure. So for getting a basic understanding on longevity, I would really recommend our Longevity Education Hub. Really just www.longevity.degree. It's really for everyone, not only for physicians, and it's for free and always will be.
Oh my goodness.
Because that's our passion. We want to educate. And there you can also find recommended literature and papers and books that you can follow. Of course, you know, the great books that, you know, everybody should read. Lifespan of David Sinclair, Aging Later from Neil Barzilay, and several others, of course, are on there. For those who would like to have updates, I very much recommend the two platforms that talk about longevity in a very credible way, which is Longevity Technology and Lifespan.io. And, you know, every now and then looking up ERDD, which is now I think the biggest conference on aging and longevity, so agingpharma.org, you will find there also on YouTube a lot of videos from the top experts in longevity.
Wow.
So, and it's happening every year, so you have, you know, and it's a 5 days conference from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. So you have really a lot of material for the whole year to review.
That's so
it
great.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nir just loves you. And I 6 years ago, or actually maybe even more, I interviewed him for my podcast, and he is so great. I just love everything about him. I don't know why, but he's just a package of love, right?
Absolutely.
And he's so smart. He's a brilliant man. And I remember saying to him, okay, one thing that I should do for longevity. And he said metformin, and I was like, well, what is that? And he explained what it is, and I was like, do you take it? And he said, yes, I do. And I thought he was like, okay, all right, I'm not going to take that. I'm not going to do that. And then I started to read more and more, and I thought, oh, I know he's so smart. I know he's so on it. But the idea of having something that worked so well for something else actually evolved from a few things that can still be applied and is still being studied and still being understood is really so much a part of what medicine is, isn't it? It's like the old can be new again. Technology can take it to another place. It's such an exciting time. I personally am working on an AI project that I'm going to talk about soon that is a huge advancement for fashion. And I'm obsessed with AI. And so when I hear about AI in medicine, and I'm as excited because I know it means it's moving fast and the future is here.
It definitely is.
And you are such a pioneer, such a great,
so much.
Great, important part of the discovery for all of us. And we are so grateful for you and the people you work with and everything you explore on behalf of the world, Miss Global.
Thank you so much.
This has been such a great, great pleasure.
Thank you so much. You know, I have great people to look up to, such as Neil Barzilai and many others.
Yeah.
Thank you for having this platform to, you know, you are bringing longevity medicine forward by doing this, by educating people. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you for giving us things to dream about and see. And that list is very exciting. Where I can't wait to jump into it.
Likewise.
Yes.
Thank you so much.